Okay. Hello, and welcome to Nothing But Space, a weekly podcast where we talk about everything related to our universe, including the Milky Way, black holes, and other observable and non-observable phenomena. I'm your host, Francesca Fernandez, and today I will be taking you through what I hope to be a transformative journey. We're kind of going over two big ideas today, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and Schrödinger's cat experiment. So I'm sure in some science class in high school, you know, maybe biology, maybe chemistry, maybe physics, we've all heard this infamous dead cat, alive cat scenario, okay, posited by Schrödinger, where you somehow have a cat in a box and it is both alive yet dead at the same time. Like, it's neither confirmed to be alive or dead, but it's just both of these things. And for the longest time, you know, teachers would tell me this and I would just be like, okay, like, sure. But it never really made sense to me how a cat can somehow be, you know, in this like superposition of two totally opposing states until I learned about like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and like quantum probabilistic superposition. So, because this confused me for the longest time, I thought today we would clear up this confusion and go over both of these ideas once and for all so you can finally understand exactly how the hell a cat can be both alive and dead and kind of like exactly what this means in terms of implications for particle physics and physics on the microscopic level. So this is a very big idea because Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is not only like a principle of its own, but it also engenders like way more ideas than just what we're talking about today. So ideas related to the nature of reality, our conscious, the fallacies behind measuring certain properties, parallel universes. So I thought that I would do a two-part episode with Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and the ideas that it kind of encompasses because, you know, I cannot cover all of it in this one episode. So let's get started. Today we're going to be going over quantum physics, but it's essentially, you know, applicable to physics at every level. So technically, I'm going to say that this is applicable to astrophysics and therefore it fits in the podcast. Okay. So I think we should start this episode off by going over exactly what Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is by definition, because knowing the definition, and then I'll go over a few examples and then go over how that is applied to this weird dead cat, alive cat scenario, I think it'll really bring things to life and kind of clear up any sort of misunderstandings or confusion. So by definition, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is basically a limit to the precision with which certain pairs of quantum level quantities can be measured. So what this means is a key word here is pairs, certain pairs of quantum level quantities. So we're talking about pairs such as position and motion or momentum or energy and time. There is a precision on which we can measure both of these quantities in one state. So if you have a particle, for example, if you have an electron just moving around a box, there's a limit to which we can measure both its position and its momentum accurately. So we could get the position accurately, but not its momentum, or we could get the momentum accurately, but not its position. But there's a limit to which we can get both of these accurately. And because there's some limit to which we can precisely calculate both of these quantities, you know, by definition, there's a level of uncertainty because we don't have certainty regarding both of these properties. So with one of them, at least, there is some uncertainty, hence the title, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So I'm going to go over a few examples. The first one we're going to talk about is polarizing light. And I want to talk about how this can relate to uncertainty at the particle level. So imagine, well, first let's go over, you know, what a polarizer is. I guess that's our key concern right now. So imagine you have a filter, okay? Like if you think of jail cell bars, that's kind of what a polarizing filter is like. And when light passes through it, it just kind of reduces the intensity and makes it easier for you to see. So for example, some sunglasses have like polarizing qualities. So polarizing light is essentially like passing it through a filter or like passing it through some sort of filter that's shaped like jail cell bars. And the jail cell bars could either be divided horizontally, so if you imagine having horizontal bars, or vertically. So if you have light that's parallel to this polarization plane, then all the photons will directly go through. And that's because all of the openings in the polarizer, so the openings between every jail cell bar, that's because they directly align with the direction that the light is going through. So imagine if you have light that's parallel and the openings in the polarizer are also aligning with that, then all the light should be able to get through. And I guess like a way you can envision this is like if you have a plane, so in math, when you have a plane and then you have linear functions on that plane that are parallel, if the linear functions are parallel, they never intersect. So I kind of think about it like if the light is parallel to the polarizer plane, then they never quote unquote intersect. Or in other words, none of the light is filtered out by the plane. So opposite idea. If light is then perpendicular to the polarization plane, then whereas before, if they were parallel, all the light would go through. If the light is perpendicular, then no photons are going through. So it's just the opposite idea. And now where things get kind of confusing is with that kind of wonky in between. So if you have light in between where the polarization plane is not fully parallel, but it's not fully perpendicular, it's kind of like in between, then you're going to have also the photons in an in-between state where some of them are going through and some of them don't, right? And that's because when it's parallel, all of the photons would go through. When it's perpendicular, none of the photons would go through. So if you have the polarization plane kind of in between that state of being parallel and perpendicular, then the photons will also be in between that state, where technically some will go through and some won't. So some are filtered out and some aren't. So then the question here is like, that's all fine and dandy, but how do you predict which photons are going to be filtered out, okay? Because, you know, it would be nice for us to be able to tell, like, if we have a polarization plane at a certain angle, say like 45 degrees to the beam of light, which photons are going to make it through and which photons aren't. Well, here's kind of where uncertainty plays in and where I'm going to break every physicist's heart, okay? You can't predict which photons are filtered out, and that's because photons of the same energy, by law, are technically indistinguishable. So these photons all have the exact same properties, and therefore there's nothing setting them apart. So which photons pass through the filter and which photons do not pass through the filter, this is a totally random process. And, you know, nobody likes to hear that because we like to know things for certain and we like to be able to predict things using laws. But with the photons, because they're all the same energy, they're basically the same particle, just duplicated a bajillion times, we can't predict which ones pass through. And generally, this seems to contradict physics because we like to suppose and we like to think that most phenomenon in the universe can be predicted in advance, but we can't predict this at all. So from the viewpoint of like a physics enthusiast, the world should be predictable. And right now we're just like uncovering the tools and laws that'll enable us to predict it. But in this case, despite our best efforts to make predictions, like with this polarizer problem, we can't predict it at all. We can't predict which photons are going to go through, and we can't predict this particle action. So at the particulate level, there is some level of uncertainty. And that is a very, very key idea that's related to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. All right, let's go over another example. So the next one I want to give you is about a particle's motion versus its position. And you might have remembered me saying earlier that technically Heisenberg's uncertainty principle by definition means that we cannot, or there's a limit to the amount of precision with which we can measure pairs of quantities. And one of the pairs I gave as an example was a particle's motion and its position. So let's explain that here. Just off the bat, I'm going to tell you, we cannot observe both a particle's motion and its position at the same time. It's frustrating, it's annoying, and the question is like, why can't we? Because, you know, physics today and the measuring tools we have are so specific and so well crafted, like why can't we measure both of these properties at the same time? Well, let's think about particles on the very microscopic or particulate level. So particles are very sensitive and they're very easily disturbed. And this should make sense because, you know, if we think about forces and Newton's law, small masses require a small force for the motions to be altered. So if you have a really small mass, like the mass of a particle, then the force that is required to alter its motion is almost negligible. So basically, any sort of force whatsoever is going to alter its motion, okay? So then if we think about trying to measure a particle's motion, the measurements that we take just intrinsically by having a measuring device there capturing this particle's motion, that is altering the particle's natural environment. And in trying to get such an accurate representation of such a microscopic particulate, tiny particle, right? That requires a lot of precision. It's very hard. The measurements we do to get that, it alters the particle's position because the measurements have to be so specific that it's kind of messing with the particle's natural environment. And therefore, We can get the measurement that gets the particle's motion, but in doing so, we alter its position, and then its position becomes indeterminate. So then, if we get the motion, we've already altered its position, and then we can't really get the position. So we can only get one or the other. So similarly, if we try to measure its position by trying to pin down exactly what specific place this very, very, very tiny microscopic particle is, that intrinsically just induces a disturbance to the particle. And because we've kind of messed around with the particle's natural environment and disturbed it by using this sort of measuring device, we've altered its state of motion. So we can get its position, but then we change its state of motion. And so because these are kind of mutually exclusive, right, you can either get the position or the motion, but you can't know both at the same time, there's some level of uncertainty with the type of information that we can discern about these kinds of particles. So now I want to give you guys some key information that's going to inform our next example related to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and kind of uncertainty at the quantum particulate level. And this key information is that particles possess both wave and particle properties. So you may or may not have heard about how light has like a wave-particle duality, right? With the photoelectric effect, light has some sort of particle property. But when we observe like interference or like two slits, passing light through two slits, light has a wave-like property. So in that same way, basically every particle at the microscopic quantum level possesses both wave and particle properties. So it can behave as both a wave and both a particle. And so this next experiment we're gonna go over that relates to that information is known as the delayed choice experiment. And it's pretty famous. So if you imagine having two screens, okay, one in front of the other, and then the front screen has two slits in it, okay? So now imagine you send a beam of photons towards the front screen. The front screen, which has two slits in it, the photons are gonna go through both of these slits. And because they have these wave-like properties, they form an interference pattern on the second screen, right? So you have two screens, one in front of the other, the one in the front has two slits, the photons go through the two slits and then form an interference pattern on the back screen. So each individual photon that is passing through these two slits is working together somehow with the other photons to add to this final interference pattern created. And if you don't know, an interference pattern of in this way just kind of looks like, I kind of think about like a line of bright beads or a line of bright dots. So if you're in like a completely dark room and imagine you have glow-in-the-dark beads, okay? And then I guess if you're doing some like little kid experiment or whatever, imagine if you take these glow-in-the-dark beads and then you line them out on a table, right? So you're in a dark room, you light up the glow-in-the-dark beads, and that is the only thing you can see. You can only see the glow-in-the-dark beads in this little line. That's kind of what an interference pattern looks like. It's like completely dark background, and then you have these little spots of light in a line. So that happens if this front screen has two slits. An interference pattern is formed by the photons and the light that's passing through. However, what we've observed is that, say you take the two-slitted front screen and you replace it with a front screen that only has one slit, okay? If it only has one slit and you pass the light through, then no interference pattern is formed. And that's kind of wacky, because we've tried this in many ways. So if you take the front screen with one slit, imagine if you take the pattern formed from each slit. So first you take the front screen with two slits and cover up the right slit, okay? So only the photons can go through the left slit. And then you do the same thing, but you cover up the left slit so the photons can only go through the right slit. And then you take the pattern formed from both of these, so the pattern formed when the photons only went through the right slit and the pattern formed from when the photons only went through the left slit, and you put those patterns on top of each other. There's still no interference pattern formed. So when the screen only has one slit, even if you somehow manage to superimpose an image created from using each of these slits separately, there's no interference pattern. The interference pattern is only formed when you have both slits in the screen. And so what that means is that each photon somehow is able to know that the other slit is covered up, and they don't work to create the same interference pattern if there's only one slit. It's as if the photon has this mysterious, weird knowledge that one slit is covered up, or that they're only going through, and they only have the option to go through one slit. And that's wacky. And what's weirder is that, okay, so some people have thought about like, well, what if the photon is transmitting information? And what I mean by that is that, say the photon, it's heading towards the screen and you've covered up one of the slits, and then somehow maybe it divides itself into two. And so one part goes towards the right slit and one part goes towards the left slit. And then it realizes, the left slit is covered up, and then it somehow transmits that information to the right photon. And then the right photon is able to go through the right slit and not form the interference pattern because it knows somehow that the left slit is covered up. Well, that's not possible because photons are indivisible. So it's not as if the photon could even do that. That's not how it works. Okay, so then what we were thinking is like, what if we kind of prank the photons, or what if we try to outmaneuver them? So what if we let one photon go through the slits when both of the slits are open, and then after it's passed through the slits and it's on its way towards the second screen, then we cover up one of the slits. And then because it's already gone through both slits, it'll technically be forced to work towards creating an interference pattern. And here is where I say, ha ha, that doesn't happen. And even if we do that, for some reason, the photon does not act in a manner that creates an interference pattern. Even if we let it go through both of the slits, and then after it's passed through the first screen, we cover up one of the slits. So, yeah, photons are crazy. They have a mind of their own. And if we try to measure which slit the photon went through, it's so disturbed by the act of measurement that it no longer works towards forming an interference pattern. And this is kind of related to the example we talked about before with like a particle's position and momentum, right? If we try to measure exactly which slit it went through or the position, then we disturb the particle and alter its motion. And therefore the motion changes, so it's no longer working towards creating an interference pattern. The reason we kind of call this the delayed choice experiment is because the physicist's choice after the photon has already passed through the first screen still affects the photon, and that doesn't make any sense. It's weird. And so because there's a lot of uncertainty regarding what we can observe about the photon, we can either see its trajectory and what slit it goes through, or we can see an interference pattern, but not both. That kind of relates to the uncertainty at the quantum particulate level and therefore Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Now, the last example I want to give you before finally talking about what we've all been waiting for, which is the dead cat, alive cat thing, is an electron in a box. So suppose you have an electron in a box and the electron is just zooming around, okay? And then you put a divider in the middle of the box, splitting the box into two equal halves. So now we don't know which half of the box the electron is in, and we won't know until we measure it or until we look inside and see. But what we do know, based off the fact that particles can have wave-like properties, is that the electron's wave is in both chambers. So before we measure where the electron is, we don't know where the electron is. We know that its wave is in both chambers. So the wave is in both sides of the box. It's not confined to one. But once we measure the electron, so as soon as we look inside and see which chamber the electron is in, the wave function is no longer available in both chambers. It abruptly disappears from one of them. So for example, if we open the box and we see that the electron is in the left chamber, then the wave disappears from the right chamber. So that's kind of weird. It's again more uncertainty at the particle and quantum level about kind of like what's going on. Okay, so now before we talk about the cat, I have to tell you about quantum superposition, and then this is what's going to actually make sense with the cat. So, because we have uncertainty regarding information about the state of the particle, right? We don't know its location, or we don't know its motion if we know its position, or we don't know its position if we know its motion. We have all of this uncertainty until we measure the particle. And often when we measure a particle, we lose other bits of information about a particle's state. So if we measure its position, we lose information about its motion. And if we measure its motion, we lose information about its position. In the example I just gave you guys with the electron in the box, if we measure the location of the electron amidst both chambers, then we lose its wave properties in the other chamber, right? When before it had wave properties in both chambers, once we measure exactly which chamber the electron is in, then its wave properties disappear from the other chamber. So until we measure information about a particle, since we are so uncertain about its state, right, because it's so small, it could have a variety of different properties in terms of like its location, its motion, etc. Because we're so uncertain about all of this, technically the particle is in a superposition of multiple states. And that's the best that we can assume. And that's because the particle is technically in every possible state at once, since we can't really accurately predict which state it'll be in or rule in any or rule out any of the possible states due to uncertainty. And so, because we are so uncertain about which state out of the many available ones it could be in, we have to leave all of our options open. And therefore, we have to presume, okay, we cannot presume that it's in one of these states because we don't know which one. So we just have to presume that until we can measure which state it's in, it's just somehow in every single different state. And then only for certain can we give information about exactly what state it's in once we measure it. So TLDR, since the particle could be in many different states, we have to assume that somehow it's inhabiting every single state at once. And so let me go back to the electron in a box analogy. Until we check and see exactly which side of the box the electron is on, we just have to presume that it's in a state of being on both sides, okay? And that's kind of shown through the electron's wave properties, because the wave function exists in both chambers until we check and measure exactly which side or which chamber the electron is in. And then as soon as we measure which side the electron is on, then it's no longer in a superposition of multiple states, right? Because we finally determine for certain exactly which state it's in. And so since we know and we've seen which side the electron is on, the wave function collapses, or the wave disappears from the other chamber, the chamber that the particle is not in. When we measure a particle and we know exactly what state it is in for certain, we call this collapsing the wave function. And we say that it's collapsed because we can technically calculate probabilities for every state that the quantum particle could be in. And so once we know exactly what state it's in by measuring, once we know this information, we don't need these calculated probabilities. We don't need the predictions of our wave function anymore. And so therefore we can quote unquote collapse it and stop using it. And so that's why we say once we determine which side of the box the electron is in, we can just quote-unquote collapse the wave function and ignore any other probabilities that we've calculated. Okay, so for this last part, now we can talk finally about the dead cat, alive cat scenario, or Schrodinger's cat experiment. And this experiment relates thoroughly to quantum superposition. And so now that we've talked about how a particle can be in a superposition of multiple states at once, now it should make sense how the cat can be both alive and dead. And so Schrodinger posited that this cat is technically a stand-in for a particle, okay? In real life, we wouldn't really say that large objects or objects that are not at the quantum or microscopic scale can be in a superposition of multiple states. But we're using the cat as a stand-in for one of these electrons or one of these particles. So Schrodinger said if you have a cat in a box with radioactive material, something to measure radioactive decay, and a flask of poison, then if the material is measured as decaying, the flask of poison will be shattered and the cat will die. And if the material is not measured as decaying, then obviously the flask of poison is not shattered and the cat is still in the box and alive. But the caveat here is that since this is all in a box, the cat is in the box, the radioactive material is in the box, the measuring device is in the box, the poison is in the box, we don't know whether the material actually decayed or not. And if the material didn't decay, then the poison wouldn't be shattered. And if the material does decay, then, you know, the poison would be shattered. So because we don't know whether the material has been decaying since it's in the box, we don't know whether the cat is alive or dead. So the cat could be both alive or it could be dead. But because we're so uncertain, because we cannot tell and know for sure what has happened to that cat, we can't ascertain what state the cat is in. And so by our theories of quantum superposition, which I explained earlier, the cat is in a superposition of both states. It's both alive and dead at the same time. And so until we freaking open the box and look inside, or in more scientific terms, until we measure whether the cat is really alive or dead, because we are so uncertain and we really cannot tell and we cannot really discern any information about this, we just have to assume that the cat is both alive and dead. We cannot rule out any of these possibilities. So now that we've gone over all of that, I hope that finally cleared up confusion about this really weird property, because Schrodinger's cat experiment confuses everyone, I feel like. It doesn't really make sense until you understand the idea of quantum superposition and how that relates to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So thank you so much for tuning into this episode. The mysterious nature of particles is seriously super fascinating, and it's like the particles basically have a life and a mind of their own, and that is so cool. And so just to be honest, what inspired me to make this episode was this book by Davies and Brown, who are both physicists, and it's titled The Ghost and the Atom. And I read it and my mind was blown. There's a lot of interviews in there with prominent quantum physicists, and they go over a lot of these ideas in a lot of depth. It's very fascinating, very complex, but if you liked this episode and you like these kinds of topics where we really explore like how particles are so mysterious and kind of have a mind and life of their own, then I highly recommend that you guys take a look at this book. Thank you guys for listening, and if you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to share this podcast with your friends, okay? It would mean a lot to me, and it would mean even more if you would be able to leave a nice review and a nice rating for us on Apple Podcasts, so that way more people can find the podcast and we can have a bigger community of space nerds, okay? I just wanted to tell you guys are the best. Thank you for listening, and have a great day, okay? Okay, bye now.